Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it's November 15th. We're going to talk about lymphatic system today. And then there's something important happening next class period, which is Wednesday. What's that? Yeah, you got an exam, your fourth exam, and then after that there's only one left over. That's the final exam. Final exam is just a regular exam, nothing special about it. You got 2 hours to take it, but you'll only need the same amount of time. So for the test on Wednesday, it is going to cover chapters 13, central nervous system, 14, peripheral nervous system, 15, autonomic nervous system, so just nervous system, and then 16, which is special senses, that's almost like nervous system, and then 19, which is heart, and that's it. So today is the last day that students in my labs will be getting practicums, and then after that we'll move on to that last test. Here's the sign-in sheet for today. So if you want me to know that you're in class, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Pass that around. All right, so lymphatic system. Okay, first, the composition of the lymphatic system. We've got lymph. You're going to be really tired of hearing that word lymph. Lymph something, lymph this and that. Lymph is a lot like blood, except it does not have red blood cells. It might have some white blood cells in there, but pretty much it's just the fluid part of blood. So it contains water and electrolytes, and that's about it. Okay, and we're going to see that it actually comes from blood, is derived from blood. And then there are lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are cells that help fight infection in your body to help keep you healthy. And then, of course, that lymph, that fluid, needs a tube to flow through, and that's what we call a lymph vessel. Lymph vessels are going to be a lot like veins. And there are lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are just a series of sites for lymphatic tissue that filter lymph as it flows from tissue spaces back to the heart. And lymph nodes filter the lymph. They look for bacteria and other things that shouldn't be in your body. And then that helps, then the lymph nodes help develop an immune response to them. We've got tonsils. Where are your tonsils at? Like point, what part of your body? Yeah, mostly up in your head and neck. All right, that's lymphatic tissue. It helps fight infections, kind of like a lymph node, but it doesn't necessarily filter lymph. They're just there to help fight infection that's trying to enter through your nose and oral cavity. Spleen, right, is pretty close to your stomach. That filters blood, just like lymph nodes filter lymph. The spleen filters blood to get rid of microorganisms that are in blood and some other functions that we'll talk about. And the thymus gland is in your mediastinum, and this is where certain kinds of lymphocytes go to mature. All right, so you'll learn a little bit about the lymphatic system, not a whole lot, but a little bit today. Okay, so the function of all of these different lymphatic organs, it helps maintain fluid balance in your body. All right, so if we look at a capillary bed, right here. So here's a typical capillary bed. Let's look at this part right here. Here's a capillary bed, and you see an arterial supply bringing blood to this network of capillaries, and a lot of fluid moves from a capillary into the tissue spaces, right, bringing oxygen and nutrients with it. About 30 liters a day leave your circulatory system and flows around all of these different cells in your body right here. So what is 30 liters like? 30 liters like. How big is that bottle right there? How big is that bottle? That's maybe half a liter? Maybe something like that? How big is your bottle right there? Is that half a liter? No, that's about a liter maybe. That's a liter. So 30 of those bottles flow out of your cardiovascular system, float around throughout between all your tissue spaces. Right? So a lot of fluid leaves your circulatory system, and you would dehydrate like that. Right. If another process didn't happen, and that is, right, at the distal end of a capillary, some of that fluid is resorbed. So 27 liters gets resorbed and put back in the capillary system. So 30 liters leaves, the proximal part of a capillary, 27 gets resorbed. So what is that left? 3 liters, right, gets left in your interstitial space, and all right, that can be a problem, because if that doesn't get returned to the cardiovascular system, you'll dehydrate. But what would happen to you? Every day you'd get 3 liters bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then eventually you just pop, right? Okay, so to help return that 3 liters of fluid back to your body, there is this lymphatic system. So these little colored vessels right here are your lymph vessels. They reclaim, they recapture that additional 3 liters of fluid so that that doesn't stay in your tissue spaces, and then it gets returned to subclavian veins that are close to the heart. So that's one of the important functions of the lymphatic system. Right? So in the big scheme of things, you've got all of these vessels right here start to return lymph back to your heart so that you don't become dehydrated. All right, so who's carrying on up there? Are you disturbing any other students that are listening to lecture? Like Elizabeth? Shh. No, you can't even hear me. Hush, you guys. Okay, if you need to yak, go out in the hall or something so you don't disturb anybody else. Okay. All right, so that's one function. So you can imagine, for instance, if your lymphatic system gets damaged, like if these lymphatic vessels right here get damaged, what's one of the side effects of damage to these lymphatic vessels? Okay, well, it might be infection, but all of this fluid that's stuck in these tissue spaces here doesn't get returned to the cardiovascular system, so edema or swelling in that part of the body is going to happen, all right, when that gets damaged. Okay, so that's one thing. What are some other things? Fat absorption. Okay, we absorb sugars and amino acids in capillaries within the digestive tract, but not lipids, not fats. Fats get absorbed by special structure called lacteals, and one of my labs still hasn't seen what a lacteal is, but I think I've got a slide here that I can show you. All right, and when fat gets absorbed and mixed with lymph, it becomes a milky white kind of fluid that we call chyle. All right, and then eventually it gets put into the circulatory system and metabolized. Third important part of the lymphatic system is the self-defense system, right? Lymph nodes, we said, filter lymph of pathogens, and the spleen filters blood of pathogens, and once the lymphatic system has contained a pathogen and isolated, then it learns how to develop a resistance to it, right? So lymphocytes are the cells within the lymphatic system that learn how to fight infections, but it takes actually probably a couple weeks for the lymphatic system to learn how to effectively fight an infection. All right, that's why some things like the flu can be really dangerous for some people, because when you get the flu, how long does it take to get over it? About 2 weeks, right? And if it's a very virulent kind of flu, right, if you're not strong enough to survive that first 2 weeks, you could actually, right, die as a result of that flu virus. Okay. All right, and then sometimes in lab I showed this to people too. There are aggregates of lymphatic tissue in various parts of your body, especially in mucosal linings of your body. And there's a mucosa that lines your digestive tract. And remember, the mucosa is the deepest layer of the digestive tract. And it contains lymphoid tissue that we call MALT, mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue. And this helps fight infections as well. And there are vast quantities of this kind of lymphatic tissue all over, throughout your digestive tract, respiratory tract, right, and reproductive tracts. And these just contain centers that can learn how to fight infections. All right, so let's look at lymph vessels first. Lymph vessels carry lymph away from tissues, all right, and that's just the fluid part that was found in blood vessels that leaves the proximal end of a capillary, right? And then, since the capillary can't resorb all of the fluid that it has leaked out, then it's a job of those lymph vessels to absorb it and start to carry it back to the heart. So those lymph vessels right here pretty much are like capillaries. It has a couple little structural modifications to it, except they are what? Little dead-end pouches right here. It's not a complete circulatory system, but this is where lymph begins. And so this is what we call a lymph capillary. It's similar to a circulatory system capillary. The modification is that there are little valves, little flaps within lymph capillaries that can kind of open and close with different kinds of muscle movement and respirations and things like that. So lymphatic capillaries actually can swallow tissue fluid, and then that tissue fluid starts to flow back toward the circulatory system. All right, I might have to flip through a couple slides. Oh, I got to go back. Okay. And so what modification does a vein have compared to an artery that makes sure that blood flows only back to the heart, not down back down to an extremity someplace? It's got valves. That's right. And so lymphatic vessels have valves as well. So here you can see a valve, and it looks pretty much just like the valve within a vein, and that's made out of the endothelial lining of this lymphatic vessel right here. So there are numerous valves. All right, so after a lymph capillary swallows some tissue fluid, it makes its way back up to the heart, right? It's emptied into a subclavian vein. And notice that it has to pass at least one of these structures before it gets back to your circulatory system. And this is what we call a lymph node. And the lymph node filters lymph, and it looks for pathogens, and it helps fight infections as well. So there's always at least one lymph node on the way back to the heart. Okay, so lymph capillaries anastomose together to form vein-like lymph vessels. And the lymph vessels contain valves to prevent retrograde flow. And lymph makes its way back to the heart due to the skeletal muscle pump, right? And the respiratory pump that we talked about in terms of venous return to the heart, right? And the other thing that lymphatic vessels have that veins don't have, right, is smooth muscle. So it can constrict and it can help move lymph fluid back to the heart as well. Okay. Well, just like the cardiovascular system has some asymmetry, remember when we studied bones and senses like eyes and things like that? If you have a radius on one side of your body, what do you got on the other? You got a radial bone on the other side of your body, right? Nice bilateral symmetry. But that doesn't necessarily always have to be the case, and the lymphatic system is another example. All right, so the heart is not perfectly symmetrical. It's not perfectly placed right in the center of your body. And the lymphatic system kind of is along that same line. All right, so the right lymphatic duct drains lymph from the right upper limb, right, and vessels from the right half of the head, neck, and chest go into the right lymphatic duct. And then that goes into the right subclavian vein. But the rest of the body drains into the thoracic duct, which is the whole left side of the body and parts of the right side of the body. So let's take a look and see what that distribution is like. Okay, so here we see the lymphatic system. All right, we see a bunch of lymph nodes all over the place. There's a spleen we were talking about. And this area right here, and it's kind of shaded like a yellow color or something, and the rest of the body is kind of shaded in like maybe a red or pink kind of color. Okay. The right lymphatic duct is right here. And so it just drains lymph from the right arm and the right upper torso and the right side of the head, empty into the right subclavian vein. But lymph from the rest of the body goes into the lymphatic duct, right, which then makes its way back to the left subclavian vein. So it's the whole left side of the body, the right abdominal region and the right lower appendage all go into the thoracic duct right here. And here is a big collecting basin right here called the cisterna cavae that just helps return lymph back to the cardiovascular system. Okay. And as you can see, as lymph returns to the heart, whether it's to the right lymphatic duct or the thoracic duct, it has to pass through at least one of these lymph nodes right here. Okay, so let's start to talk about some lymphatic organs. All right, so lymph organs are composed of lymphocytes, macrophages, and other kinds of cells. Lymphocytes are responsible for fighting infection in one of a couple ways, and I'll maybe talk about the two ways that do that. and macrophages. A macrophage is a blood cell. It's a white blood cell. And one kind of white blood cell that you had to know, I think, was called a monocyte. And a monocyte can move by diapedesis. It's a shapeshifter. It can change its shape and crawl between cells through amoeboid motion or diapedesis. And when it runs into a foreign particle, it surrounds that particle and then brings it back to a germinal center, which could be a lymph node or could be some malt tissue someplace in your body or a spleen or a tonsil. And in those germinal centers, then the lymphatic tissue learns how to recognize that pathogen by its shape and develop resistance to it. So lymphocytes learn how to fight that particular fungus or virus or bacteria or whatever that infectious particle is. And the two kinds of lymphocytes, there's a B lymphocyte that makes antibodies. These are molecules that are soluble in plasma and they float around your circulatory system. And when it bumps into one of those bacteria that it's been designed to fight, then it just grabs hold of it and breaks the membrane. And when the membrane lyses, then that bacteria essentially dies as a result. That's a B lymphocyte. Another kind of lymphocyte is a T lymphocyte, and the T lymphocyte is a contact killer. It's a cell that is not stuck in the germinal center, but can move around in your circulatory system, and when it bumps into a bacteria, it blows that bacteria up by binding to it and lysing the plasma membrane. Maybe some of you have seen that Star Trek episode. Anybody see that Star Trek episode where they're visiting a planet and one of the defensive mechanisms of the planet was to scan the whole ship, okay? And then they would build a robot that looked exactly like a crew person, like Captain Kirk. And if that robot ever touched Captain Kirk, they would both be annihilated, right? They just blow up. But if that robot that looked like Captain Kirk touched any other crew person, then it would have no effect, because it was matched up perfectly for that particular crew member. So the same thing with these contact killers, these T lymphocytes, right? If they bump into a cell that they've been taught to annihilate, then it does a really good job. But if it bumps into any other kind of bacteria, then it would have no effect on it because it hasn't learned how to fight that particular infection yet.
What is the B1 doing?
The B1 makes antibodies, which are chemicals that float around in the blood and bind to foreign substances, and then eventually those infectious cells will lyse and be destroyed. So the B lymphocytes make chemicals that fight infections. The T lymphocytes are actually cells that fight infection. So one is a chemical way of fighting infection, and the other is a cellular way of fighting infection. Okay. So microorganisms stimulate lymphocyte cell division. All right, how do you do cell division? What's the name of that process? Yeah, mitosis, right? And so that's why we say that these cells live in germinal centers. What does it mean to germinate? Like if you have a seed and you plant it in soil and you water it, the seed kind of comes to life, right? And we say it germinates. So that means that it grows, it gets bigger, and it undergoes a lot of mitosis so that the plant gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Remember, that's one of the important functions for mitosis, is for growth, right? So growth happens in germinal centers within the lymphatic system. So these lymphocytes undergo mitosis. We call that proliferation. Proliferation just means you start with one cell or a handful of cells, and then you have what? Hundreds, and you got thousands, and you got tens of thousands of cells undergoing that proliferation, and all those tens of thousands of cells can fight infection, either by producing antibodies or by becoming contact killers. So germinal centers are found in lymph nodes and in tonsils and in that malt tissue all over mucosa linings in your body. And when a germinal center becomes activated because it's been stimulated by a foreign substance, we call that immune system activation. So immune system activation happens in a germinal center. And the kinds of things that can stimulate immune system activation are what we call antigens. And I think we talked about antigens way back when we were talking about the cell. because antigens are these molecules that are on the plasma membrane that stick off the plasma membrane, and they have a particular shape, and all of the cells in your body have a marker, an antigen that have a particular shape. And for instance, if this is your shape, okay, guess what shape every cell has? It has this one right here. So when a lymphocyte is wandering around in your body, if it bumps into a cell that has an antigen of this shape, it knows what? It belongs to you, and it shouldn't get killed. But if it has a different shape like this, it says, ah, that cell doesn't belong to you. We need to teach these lymphocytes how to recognize that shape and destroy those cells. Okay, in what? Germinal center. So antigens activate the immune system. Okay, and one of the places where this happens are the tonsils. And you have three sets of tonsils, and that protects your body from microorganisms trying to get in through your nasal cavity, oral cavity. All right, so there are palatine tonsils in your posterior oral cavity. So if you go up to a mirror and stick your tongue out and go, ah, those are the things that kind of vibrate back and forth that you're looking at, way in the back of your throat. Those are the palatines. The pharyngeal tonsils are way up in your nasal cavity. Those you can't see very easily just by looking in a mirror. You need like a dental hygienist mirror to kind of look way up into the nasal cavity. And then the lingual are right at the base of the tongue, posterior tongue, and those really are hard to see as well. Okay, so all of these, and the pharyngeal sometimes are called adenoids. The palatines are usually just called tonsils, okay? They don't have a special kind of name. And these tonsils right here can become chronically infected in some people. And what do you call that part of your body that these tonsils are in? Where did we say they are? Oral cavity. What's your posterior oral cavity? Which is a common pathway for air that you're breathing and food that you're eating. That's your pharynx, right? Okay. So when they become chronically infected, you have like a chronic pharyngitis. What's a pharyngitis in everyday language? It's a sore throat, okay? And as a matter of fact, that can be a really severe sore throat to where maybe it's so bad that you don't even go to work every other week, something like that, because your throat is so sore. So you can imagine what it would be like if you could only come to class every other week or every 3 weeks or maybe every 4 weeks. What would happen? Yeah, you'd get dropped probably, right? So it'd be hard to have any kind of normal life with chronically infected tonsils. It happens to little kids. And if it doesn't respond to long courses of antibiotics, then those tonsils have to be removed, ablated. And in little kids, it's not such a big surgery. They're probably eating ice cream that very same day and want to run around, right? But for an adult, it's a pretty serious kind of surgery. And you might actually be out of work for 2 weeks, right? But and you certainly won't feel like eating anything for numerous days, right? And maybe some ice cream, because your tonsils are maybe about as big as the tip of your thumb, okay? And they're kind of buried in your throat, so you can imagine, right? If somebody took that, gouged that amount of tissue out of you and just left it open, that you would be really, really sore. And that certainly indeed is the case. They can't really suture that surgical site closed because that will form a pocket. And what do we call a pocket like that? It usually becomes infected, and so that would be an abscess, right? So they have to be left open, and then they granulate from the inside out and heal over very nicely. So it's kind of a long process for adults, but after you get those palatines removed, you might not have a sore throat for a year or maybe two, something like that. So can you imagine how that would change somebody's life? Just amazing, from being sick every other week or every third week to being like a healthy, normal person again. So tonsillectomies, if they're chronically infected, don't respond to antibiotics, right, then I certainly would highly recommend you just get them pulled. Now you might be asking, what would be a question that you might ask? Right, in the normal circumstance, these tonsils fight infection. But now if we take them out of somebody, what would be a good question you would ask? Yeah, are you going to be more susceptible to infection, right, since you don't have those tissues? But you know what? You have so much malt all over your body that these other lymphatic tissues kind of take over the job of the tonsils that you lost, and usually there is no consequence to that, right? So As a matter of fact, in the digestive system that we're looking at in lab today, there is some special malt in a vestigial part of the large intestine that's hanging off the cecum that's called the appendix. And in people, its whole job is to fight infection, right? It's like a big, huge lymph node right there, and that can be chronically inflamed, and then it's removed. And again, once that's removed, it really poses no big health threat to the individual because there's so much lymphatic tissue all over your body constantly fighting infection that the other parts of your body just kind of take over, mostly. Okay, let's go on to a lymph node. Okay, there's small round structures along lymphatic vessels, and remember, lymph has to pass through at least one of these before it gets back to the subclavian vein. And there are some aggregations of lymph nodes in the inguinal region, that's your groin, axillary region, where's that? Armpit, cervical region is your neck, all right? So here are some lymph nodes in the axillary region, in the cervical region, inguinal region right here. And sometimes a healthcare provider might palpate these superficial lymph nodes to see if they're inflamed. Because if you have an infection, what happens when you have an infection? And those macrophages bring bacteria back to these lymph nodes right here. What happens to those lymph nodes? Yeah, the immune system becomes activated. Those cells start to proliferate. All the lymphocytes start to grow by mitosis, right, and learn how to fight that infection. And as those lymphocytes proliferate, it expands the size of that lymph node and it becomes tender as a result of that and hurts. So if somebody's interested to see if you just have a localized infection or a systemic infection, if lymph nodes are swollen all over your body, that would be a systemic infection, then that's maybe one really easy way to tell if the infection is localized to one part of your body or if it's systemic. Okay, so that happens when the lymph nodes become activated when they're presented with an antigen of some kind. Okay, so function is to filter lymph, produce lymphocytes. Activation of the immune system happens through lymphocyte cell division, right, through proliferation. And there are macrophages in lymph nodes that can phagocytize pathogens and then share them with other parts of the immune system so that you learn how to fight that particular infection. All right, well, let's look at some histology of a lymph node. Okay, it kind of looks like a kidney almost like a kidney bean, but it's a lot smaller. They're kind of like the size of a pea or maybe a little bit smaller. And it's surrounded by a capsule, okay, with invaginations of the capsule right here that we call trabeculae. Kind of reminds you of what, trabecular bone or spongy bone right here. Here is a vessel, a lymphatic vessel that's bringing lymph to the node, and this is what we would call an afferent vessel. And then lymph filters through all of these different cells, and then it leaves the lymph node through these efferent lymphatic vessels right here. And look what all these vessels have. They have valves in them, right? Kind of reminds you of veins. Okay. This part of a lymph node where the efferent vessels are attached, notice there's a little indentation right here. This is what we call the hilum. And the hilum is just a special place on any kind of organ that has a certain maybe blood supply. There are blood vessels that attach there, or lymphatic vessels, or nerves can enter or leave the organ right in this particular location. That's the hilum. So the lungs have a hilum. The kidneys have a hilum. And have you ever seen a real bean in real life? Like a plant, like some beans you would cook at home? All right, they have a little spot right here. All right, and that's called the hilum as well, because that's where the seed was attached to, what, the mother plant, right at that location, right? That's where it was attached to the pea pod or bean pod or whatever. So that's just the attachment point to the rest of the organism, called the hilum. Okay, so I think that's what I want you to know about lymph nodes. All right, spleen. See what we can find for spleen. Okay, here's some more lymph nodes. So lymphatic tissue is made out of reticular connective tissue. Oh, look at all this stuff we're not going to talk about. Okay, here is a picture of the small intestine and all these little nodules right here. These are germinal centers. And we would call, and it's in the mucosa part of the wall of the small intestine. So what do we call these things right here? What do we call these lymphatic nodules that are in the mucosa layer?
Malt.
Yeah, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. All right, so that's a pretty good picture of them right there. Spleen. Well, we know where the spleen is because we're starting to do some dissections in lab right here. Okay, but let me find spleen in particular. That's pretty good. So, oh, here's spleen. How do I make it big? Come on, make it big. Is this it? Oh, I went to the other page again. Hold on, I'll be right back. Okay, so here's a spleen, and you can see that the job of the spleen is not to filter lymph, but to filter blood. All right, so here's the arterial supply to the spleen, and there's a capsule on the spleen. The medulla of the spleen is just reticular connective tissue with lymphatic tissue. And what can you tell me about reticular connective tissue? What can you remember? It's fairly fragile, right? Reticular fibers are the weakest kind of fiber. They're even weaker than elastic fibers. Okay, so this red pulp right here filters blood, and maybe I didn't tell you this, but a red blood cell. What's the lifespan of a red blood cell? Yeah, it's about 120 days. Maybe we did talk about that in this class. And a red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus, so it can't repair any damage. So it has a very short lifespan. All right, so it's the job of the spleen to take a red blood cell that is about 120 days old and break it down into components that red bone marrow can use to resynthesize red blood cells. That's what happens in red pulp. White pulp right here contains germinal centers to fight infection, right, and can be used to filter even lymph. Right, so that's what we see in the medulla of the spleen. And since, and look at these big splenic, here are the cords that contain lymphatic tissue, and then here are the arterioles and capillaries. And these pockets of blood right here are just what we call sinuses. So these are just big pools of blood that's being filtered by the splenic cords. And this is all held together with reticular connective tissue, which is what? Relatively weak fibers. So if the spleen is ever traumatized, it just has a tendency to fracture and rip, unfortunately. And look how vascular it is. Would you say, how would you describe this vascularity? It's highly vascular, so that means that once the spleen is damaged, right, it produces a fairly massive hemorrhage. And unfortunately, okay, since it's only reticular connective tissue, for instance, if somebody wanted to place a suture in a spleen that has been lacerated, even just the placement of a suture in this material right here is going to cause it to rip even more, all right, so and produce even a greater hemorrhage. So what has to be done is that someplace proximal to that laceration, you have to find some big blood vessels. And just like the fetal pig in lab, then we place some ligatures around these blood vessels, and then that whole part of the spleen has to be removed as a result of that. And hopefully, you remove just a very small part of the spleen and not the whole spleen. Because again, right, you're getting rid of some of the natural function that normally occurs in your body for your immune system. And usually that doesn't play much of a role, just like if you lose your tonsils, or if you lose your appendix, right? If you lose your whole spleen, again, that's probably not going to affect your everyday immune response, but under certain circumstances, it might. For instance, if the reason why the spleen is being removed because you were in a bad motorcycle accident, for instance, All right. Some other things could happen. Maybe you could really fracture some bones really bad. And a lot of times, they have to put bones back together with hardware, like screws and pins and things like that. And whenever somebody puts a prosthesis in your body, there's always a really high risk of infection. That's just always the case. All right. And if you just so happen that you've lost your spleen, guess what? That rate of infection goes way up to where the surgeons really have to figure out and judge whether they're going to actually place any pins or screws to hold bones back together. You might actually opt not to have any place because you're immunocompromised as a result of that, losing that spleen. So under some rare circumstances, splenectomies can affect your immune system, but typically not in an everyday sense. Okay. The other thing that the spleen does is that it's a reservoir for red blood cells. So for instance, if you do sustain some kind of hemorrhage, it can release a lot of red blood cells back into your circulatory system, right? And that helps just preserve your red blood cell volume and prevent you from becoming anemic until those red blood cells can get built back up again. Okay, so that takes us to another organ, which is the thymus. All right, where the heck is the thymus at? That's back over here someplace. Let me go back and look. All right, so we were talking about the spleen. Okay, so here's the thymus right here, superior mediastinum. It's above the heart, so here's the cardiac notch in the lungs. Here's the thymus. And the job of the thymus is that this is where some lymphocytes go and mature and learn how to become contact killers. So what kinds of cells become contact killers? The T cells, right? So this is a place where T cells go to become activated and to undergo their final stage of maturation, all right? And as a matter of fact, they are named T cells because of thymus. Starts with a T, right? This is where they were recognized to happen. So that's the job of the thymus gland. Okay, so maturation. Oh, it says right here in your notes, T lymphocytes. All right, so I think that's what I want you to know about the lymphatic system. Probably the most important thing. Well, no, let me say one other thing, too, about lymphatic system. Let me go back to this picture right here. All right, well, let's just say that you have a tumor, for instance, in your forearm right here, and it is metastasizing. So some of those cells are breaking away from that tumor and moving to other locations in your body, right? And when they move to another location, then they'll form a tumor in that location. And that can happen in the liver, right? And brain, anywhere in the body, right? And one of the ways that those cells like to move from the primary site of the tumor to secondary tumor locations is through the lymphatic system. So a lot of times when somebody's removing a tumor from your body, they also harvest some lymph vessels and look for tumor cells in those lymphatic vessels, all right? And they might actually take out a few lymph nodes as well and look at those lymph nodes to see if there's tumor cells in there, all right? So when they take out those lymphatic vessels and lymph nodes, right, what happens to this forearm right here? Well, it's nice because you've gotten rid of the cancer, but what's the function, what's one of the main functions of the lymphatic system is to drain lymph back to the heart, but if those vessels are gone, guess what happens to all that tissue fluid? It stays in the forearm, okay, and then it just swells up. So that's always a consequence of removing lymphatic blood vessels or nodes from somebody when they're trying to remove cancer cells from the lymphatic system. Cancer cells can also travel along nerves underneath through the endoneurium, okay, and blood vessels as well. But one of their favorite tricks is to travel through the lymphatic system. And hopefully these lymph nodes have been smart enough to recognize those tumor cells and filter them out before they do what? Progress any further to different parts of the body when that happens. But that's just a consequence of removing those lymphatic vessels. Okay, so that's for lymphatic system. I've got some slides in the digestive system that show where the tonsils are and what a lacteal looks like. So I think we're just going to move on to respiratory system. So let's find respiratory system. And that's 21. Is it 21 still in your book? They reordered the... No, that's lymphatic system. 22. Okay, so let's start just by reviewing some of the functions of the respiratory system. Well, one important function is ventilation. Ventilation is just breathing in and out of your body, just breathing air in and out. And air is a fluid. It's going to move. Does anybody know why a fluid moves from one location to another? We should probably think about this. This is going to be really important for a physiology class, not so important for this particular class, but real important for physiology. It moves by pressure gradients. Right, so a fluid will always move from a high pressure to a low pressure. All right, so as air is flowing into your lungs when you're inhaling, what's the pressure inside your thoracic cavity? Oh, it's low, right? So it's high in the atmosphere, low inside your thoracic cavity, so air flows in. That's the same reason why blood flows back to your thoracic cavity when you're inspiring, because the pressure is so low. We call that the respiratory pump. So that's controlled a lot by your diaphragm, mostly by your diaphragm. There's some other muscles, and there's actually two different ways that you can breathe. Right now, you're in a mode called quiet breathing, all right? But as soon as you start exercising, you have to move a lot more air in and out of your lungs, and we would call that forced breathing. So there's different muscles that are used for normal quiet breathing compared to forced breathing, which we'll talk about, okay? So ventilation, just moving air in and out of the lungs, that requires, to a large degree, skeletal muscles. Then gas exchange is important between air in the lungs and your blood, because the reason why we inhale is to absorb oxygen, right? And then that oxygen is transported in the blood. There's a special cell in blood that transports oxygen, and those are the red blood cells, okay? The red blood cells are loaded with hemoglobin, and hemoglobin can bind oxygen and carry it in the blood. It also transports CO2, which is the waste product of metabolism. And then this fourth thing would be gas exchange between blood and tissues. All right, so what do you have in the lungs that allows for exchange between air and blood? And what do you have in tissues that allows for exchange between the tissues and blood? You've got capillaries. Right? You got the capillaries, and capillaries are specialized for exchange because they're very thin. Or maybe some are really leaky, like sinusoids, for instance. All right, so those are the important functions. All right, let's look at some anatomy of the respiratory tract. So this shows the whole respiratory tract, and it can be broken down into an upper airway and a lower airway. The lower airway starts right here at the larynx. And you can see a bunch of blue in this illustration. Let me see, maybe I'll zoom in. All right, and all the blue right there represents cartilage. All right, the upper respiratory tract really doesn't have any cartilage, but it's surrounded by bony structures of the nasal cavity and the oral cavity. Okay, so the upper respiratory tract is made out of the nasal cavity and the pharynx. And then the lower respiratory tract starts here at the larynx and continues all the way down into the lungs. Okay, and so what's the job of this cartilage right here? How is it that we move air in and out of our lungs again? By pressure changes, right? So in order to inhale, the thoracic cavity has to expand, air flows in, right? And then how do we get the air out of our lungs? Okay. The thoracic cavity has to shrink. It gets smaller, And when that happens, that pressurizes your thoracic cavity, right? And if this airway right here was just a tube like the esophagus, just a soft muscular tube, when you compress your thoracic cavity, guess what would happen to the trachea right here if you were to force your rib cage down? The pressure would go up, and what would happen to the trachea? It would actually collapse, all right? And if it collapsed, air can't flow through that tube, all right? So the trachea and larynx is held open all the time with these cartilaginous rings and the various cartilages of the larynx, so that even when you're changing the pressure of the thoracic cavity, this never closes off, because if those tubes were to occlude, you would never be able to exhale, which would be bad, because what would that mean? If you can't exhale, you can't get new air in there to absorb oxygen from it, right? So these tubes are held open all the time due to this cartilage. Now that has some kind of important ramifications, because this tube is open all the time. Guess what can happen if you're horsing around, not paying attention? All you have to do is get some kind of food particle right over the opening of the larynx that we call the glottis, right, and let go, and what's going to happen to it? It's going to fall right down in through here and get lodged, and then you can't breathe in and breathe out. And then you just have, what, a matter of just a couple minutes of life, unless somebody knows what? A Heimlich maneuver, which is part of CPR training. That's a way of forcefully shooting that particle out, even way out of your mouth, okay, by doing that Heimlich maneuver right there. All right, so having the trachea held open all the time can be a little dangerous, right? But there's a structure in the lower airway, this thing right here called the epiglottis, which is a trapdoor that covers the glottis. All right, so upper airway is superior to the larynx, the lower airway is below the larynx. I don't show you nasal cartilages. You can look at nasal cartilages if you want to. All right, so here is a nice exam figure. Probably this is even a quiz figure. So here is the beginning of the lower airway with this epiglottis. This is the trapdoor that slides over the opening when you swallow something. And that usually works pretty well, except there's one day of the week. How many days are there in a week? There's seven, yeah? There's one day where this epiglottis gets a little lazy, okay? And there's a day of the week that most people choke because it gets lazy. Who knows what day that is? Sunday night, during Sunday night football? Could be, maybe, but that's not the day. What's it, Monday? Oh, Mondays, it hardly ever happens on a Monday. Saturday, maybe if you're at the country club. Okay, Friday night. And it's always associated with adult beverage, right? Adult beverage, which is what? Beer, alcohol, or whatever. Usually Friday late afternoon, 4:30, 5 o'clock, right? And it's happy hour, so you go out with a bunch of fellow students or people that you work with, right? And you share like 5 or 6 pitchers of beer and some nachos and popcorn shrimp and stuff like that, and you're telling really good stories and everybody's having a good, fun time, right? So there you are with a little popcorn shrimp. You're about ready to swallow down, and somebody says, oh yeah, well that's nothing. My anatomy instructor does such and such, right? And then all of a sudden, what happens to you? You start laughing, and what do you do when you start laughing? You inhale before you laugh, and there goes that popcorn shrimp right down into this trachea right here. Okay, so that's always a good time to pay attention if you're out in public. Friday nights, maybe Saturday nights is a second really good time, and people are having a really good time not paying attention to eating and laughing at the same time. Food goes right down through here and occludes their airway. All right, so that's really good just to be aware of that. And when you do have food in this airway right here, these vocal cords can't vibrate back and forth. So the kinds of sounds that you make won't sound like, help, please help me, I'm choking. Okay, the sounds that you make are just gurgling, nasty kinds of sounds that no one will understand. So fortunately, there is universal sign language to tell everybody, or at least those that know the sign language, that you're choking and you need help. And what's that? That's two hands right around your larynx right here. All right, so that means when you do that, that means that anybody has an invitation to come up to you and give you a Heimlich maneuver, right? So don't do it unless you really need one, because it's kind of a radical procedure. It's designed to forcefully project food out of your trachea. So if you do that, you can't sue anybody for them giving you a Heimlich maneuver. But if somebody gives you a Heimlich maneuver without your consent, of course you can sue them. All right, so that means if you're going to do a Heimlich maneuver on somebody, what should you do? Always ask first. And if they can't respond and they're turning purple, then that's a pretty good answer. All right, but you can't wait all day long for that to happen. Okay, so the common name for this part right here, which is a part of the upper airway, is the throat, right, which is, in scientific terms or anatomy terms, that's the pharynx. Right, so your throat is the pharynx, and when you get a sore throat, that's really a pharyngitis. And we can see some tonsils. Here's the lingual tonsil, here are the palatines right here, and then here are the adenoids way up over here. Right, so when these become chronically infected, you have a pharyngitis or a sore throat when that happens. Okay. The pharynx is so complicated because it's sometimes part of the nasal cavity, sometimes part of the oral cavity, sometimes part of the larynx down over here, that we actually give it some subdivisions. Right, so this part that's superior to the oral cavity, right, next to the nasal cavity, this is what we call the nasal pharynx. Just posterior to the oral cavity, this is the oral pharynx. And then this part down over here, just posterior to the larynx, this is the laryngopharynx. And there was a pretty nice slide, a couple pictures, the very last one, right, that shows very nicely now where the nasopharynx, oral pharynx, and laryngopharynx is right here, all just part of your throat. All right, so let's get back to this picture. So you got the tonsils. Here's the tongue. Here's the opening of the Eustachian tube. Where does this go? To your ear. Could this be on your test coming up? Yeah, you have senses on the test coming up on Wednesday, right? Senses. Yeah, Eustachian tube or pharyngotympanic tube goes to the middle ear, right? So this helps equalize pressure on either side of the eardrum so that the eardrum can vibrate back and forth freely. All right, here you have the nasal conchae. Right, the inferior nasal conchae is a bone all by itself, but the superior and middle really are part of the ethmoid bone, and it's coated with mucosa lining that helps absorb dust particles and also humidifies the air, warms it up if it's cold, or cools it down if it's really, really hot. Here's the sphenoid bone, sphenoid sinus, and here is, what's sitting in this region right here? Ah, this could help somebody that's got the practicum this afternoon, but they probably all left already. That's too bad. What sits right in here in the cella turcica of this sphenoid bone? That's a pituitary gland, yeah. Okay, and hypothalamus would be right about there. Okay, so what else is interesting? Oh, you see the esophagus. How would you describe the location of the esophagus compared to the trachea? It's posterior to it. Indeed, it is. And when you do your dissections, that's exactly where you're going to look at it, look for it. And how far away is it from the trachea? It's right next to it, right? So you won't have to spend a lot of time looking for it. It's going to be right there. Okay, now this esophagus doesn't have any cartilage holding it open. So how is the esophagus? What's the state of the esophagus all the time? Except just when food is transiting from the mouth down to the stomach. It's not held open, it's closed. Yeah, and when we get to the digestive system, I'll probably say some things about that. So that's unlike the trachea. So that's okay if it closes during inspiration or expiration, it doesn't matter because that bolus of food will force it open under most circumstances anyway. Okay, here's that hyoid bone. And then the other things that we see right here are just the cartilages that make up the larynx. Oh, no, there's something else too. Okay, the roof of the mouth. Right? The hard palate is made of the bony structures of the maxillary bones and the palatine bones in the back that makes the hard roof of the mouth. And then this part right here, this is the soft palate. Right? So hard palate is bony structure. The soft palate is muscle. And it's used, and this soft palate closes off, occludes the passageway to the nasal cavity when you're swallowing so that we don't get food up in the nasal cavity right here. So that's really handy when that happens. Not everybody has that guaranteed. For instance, people that have a cleft palate might have holes within the hard palate right here or through the soft palate so that when they try to eat something, food goes up over here, and it's a real pain. And of course, it's very difficult to breathe and form language as a result of that. And even more importantly, they can't nurse, right? They can't suckle when they're infants. And so that should be diagnosed very, very early and then repaired so that those individuals can develop normally as a result of that. And even malformations of the tongue. This little thing, look in the mirror when you get home, this little thing that connects right on midline to your tongue down to the mandible right here, that's called the frenulum, okay? And so there's like a little ribbon of tissue right there. This is the lingual frenulum. If there's malformations of this frenulum right here, that might also impede an infant's ability to nurse as well. All right, so there can be a lot of pathology in this region that maybe isn't so obvious and what kind of problems that it might cause. All right, so let's see what we can do for the larynx. So here's the larynx. Here's a trap door called the epiglottis, right? And when does it get lazy again? Friday, happy hour, okay. Here is the thyroid cartilage, because associated with the thyroid cartilage is the right thyroid gland. So it's an important endocrine gland. Right, that's pretty prominent. Inferior to that is the cricoid cartilage. The thyroid cartilage doesn't go all the way around, doesn't completely girdle or encircle the larynx, but the cricoid cartilage does. It's a complete ring. And then there are some other cartilages we need to look at a different perspective. Right, so here's a lateral view. Here's the cricoid. Here's the thyroid cartilage. And then we have the arytenoids. The arytenoids, along with the corniculate, have a muscle attached to it that can either put tension on these vocal folds right here, right, or release tension, and that produces different pitched sounds when these things vibrate. Right, so if the arytenoid cartilage puts tension on this true vocal fold right here, then it's going to sound like a higher pitch. And when that tension is released, then it will be a low pitch. All right, and then here is that epiglottis. Most of the cartilages of the larynx are hyaline cartilage, except for the epiglottis, that is elastic cartilage. All right, so it's a little bit more bendable. Okay, and then these are just what we call tracheal or cartilaginous rings, but they don't go all the way around to the posterior side of the trachea, because what's right on the other side of the trachea right here? The esophagus is right here, so every once in a while a big bolus of food will pass by and it has to make an indentation into the trachea, and so there's just a trachealis muscle that's posterior, so that allows for that bolus of food to make its way down into the stomach. All right, so that's the larynx. So for the last practicum, yeah, you have to know all these different cartilages, right? It's not too bad. Okay. And, all right, so I think next time I'm going to start in here someplace. Okay, I'm not sure where. Maybe windpipe. Yeah, we could talk about histology of the windpipe. We'll start by talking about histology of the windpipe. And that's probably everybody's favorite epithelium. Because what? It's a pseudostratified ciliated columnar type epithelium. All right, so make sure that you sign the sign-in sheet, please. And I have it right here.